This is probably one of the more controversial passages in the book of Philippians. And we're going to find that the solution to the passage is a very simple one. But let's just start at Philippians 2:12. And as I read that first verse, it probably is going to raise a few questions. Philippians 2:12. Therefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. What do you think of that verse?
You're on your own.
I mean, does that sound like Paul? Well, anytime you see the word salvation or saved, you always have to ask the question, who is saved from what? Who is saved from what? This passage people have made very complicated because people have viewed it as though Paul were telling people how to be saved from the lake of fire. But Paul is addressing believers. And the kind of deliverance that he's talking about is a different deliverance. But let's look at a couple of background issues in order to understand this work out your own salvation. The word that's used there for work out is katergazomai. And you say, well, that's nice. But notice in that you hear ergazomai. And we get the word energize from that same root. And this word has the idea of produce it. Paul is saying that he wants them to produce their own salvation. It's often been taken that, well, Paul's saying, let your salvation have its outworking. But that is not what the word means. The term means to produce it. Let's look at a couple of passages in order to see that. If someone could read Romans 5:3 for me.
John, in my Bible, the Good News version has a little difference too. It says,
okay.
Now that I am away, you must even be more careful to put into action God's saving work in your lives.
Okay, I'm going to find myself in disagreement with how they render it.
Okay.
Because the way that they are understanding it is, let your salvation have its outworking. That's the gist of what they're saying. In other words, they're saying, you already have salvation. So then let it work out. You know, it's kind of like whenever my parents were going to sell their house, my mother would always make bread. And so people would come in to the house and they'd smell the bread. And, you know, that was just one of those things. Anytime they were selling house, mom made bread all the time. And that's the way that a lot of people understand this passage. Let me say something about translation philosophy. There are versions of the Bible that try to make a very simple reading and try to make it easy to understand. One of the problems that happens, though, is if a translation is being translated by someone who has made a mistake on a passage, and they make it easy to understand, they'll make it easy to understand the way that the translator understood it. I prefer a translation that's a little more literal, and what that does is it makes it so that If we run into a passage that looks a little difficult, it's probably a little difficult in the Greek. And that way, we look at it and say, okay, what's going on? Whereas if we have a translation that's made it simpler for us, then the question becomes, did he make it simple the right way, or did he make it simple in a way that's leading in a different direction? His understanding is, let your salvation have its outwork.
Well, the way I read it, it says that they're already saved, and use your ability as a saved person to work out what you're going to do in the future.
And that's what I mean when I say let your salvation have its outworking. That's how they're taking that.
And you say that it's not. That you're...
Right.
Okay.
So what I'm saying is the kind of salvation that Paul is talking about is a different kind of salvation than being saved from hell. And so he's saying there is a salvation that you need, there's a deliverance you need, and I want you to bring it about. You're responsible to bring about your own deliverance. Now, we'll explain that. The way that they're going to be responsible to do that is God's way. And it will be a deliverance that God ultimately is the one who enables. Okay, Romans 5:3. Someone have that?
Not only so, but we also rejoice in our suffering. Because we know that suffering produces perseverance, character, and character hope.
Okay, produces. So read the phrase that has produces. What produces what?
It says, because we know that suffering produces perseverance, and perseverance, character, and character hope.
So suffering produces perseverance. It isn't let your suffering have its outworking. It produces it. It causes it. Okay, Romans 7:8.
But sin, seizing the opportunity afforded by the commandment, produced in me every kind of covetous desire. For apart from the law, sin is dead.
Okay, so sin produced evil desire. Romans 7:15. And here it's in the first phrase, and in translation I'm using, for what I am doing. So the word produce, what I am producing, so on and so forth. Okay, so Romans 7:15.
I do not understand what I do. For what I want to do, I do not do. For what I hate, I do.
Yeah, what Paul is talking about in this passage in Romans 7 is how he knows as a believer the right thing to do, but sin just seems to be very powerful and it's producing in him results that he's saying, now why did I do that? He's saying, I know better than that. That isn't what I wanted to do. And he's seeing how he is having a great struggle, and sin that's in him produces within him some things he doesn't want. If we want to treat our passage properly, we need to treat it as these Philippian believers are responsible to produce a deliverance. Now, it's often translated salvation. I would prefer deliverance. But the question is, in Philippians 2:12, what kind of deliverance or what kind of salvation is he talking about? Does it mean being regenerated? That is, when a person believes in Jesus Christ, they are saved. Is that what he's talking about? I don't think so. Does it mean being spared alive in this life, temporal deliverance? For example, There were 200 and some odd people that were on the ship in Acts chapter 27, that Paul was on the ship and the ship sank, and it said all the souls on the ship were saved. And in the context, nobody drowned. Even though there were over 200 people, everyone lived. They survived. That's a possible meaning, and that's actually the probable meaning, a deliverance in life in this passage. Or the, let's see, people often talk about past salvation, present salvation, deliverance in our life right now, or future salvation. Does it mean being delivered, rewardable into God's presence? Sometimes passages speak about us going to be with the Lord as salvation or deliverance, being delivered from this present life. Well, we need to ask the question, what is it that these readers need to have deliverance from? That's going to help us to understand this. Let me get back to Philippians. Back in chapter 1, we saw that these Philippians were under a lot of pressure. Go back to Philippians 1:27. Only let your conduct be worthy of the gospel of Christ, so that whether I come and see you or am absent, and right now he's in prison, he's a long way away from Philippi, he can't come to them right away, that I may hear of your affairs, that you stand fast in one spirit, with one mind, striving together for the faith of the gospel. And what was the problem that we saw that they were having in Philippi? They were at each other. They were fighting. Remember how in Philippians chapter 4 he said, remind these people that are my fellow laborers that contended with me for the gospel, remind them to get along. That here they are facing opposition from outside, and what are they doing inside? They're fighting against each other. And that's not going to result in a very good situation for them. Go on in Philippians 1:28. In addition to striving together for the faith of the gospel, and in not in any way terrified by your adversaries. He goes on in verse 29 to say, for it has been granted on behalf of Christ to you, not only to believe in him, but also to suffer for his sake, having the same conflict which you saw in me and now here is in me. Paul is saying you're starting to experience some of the difficulty and some of the persecution that's been happening with me. And how bad was that persecution for Paul? Well, let's back up a little further in chapter 1. In Philippians 1:19, Paul said, for I know that this, and he's talking about his imprisonment in Rome, will turn out for my
deliverance
or salvation. Hey, wait a moment. That's interesting. It's exactly the same word that we have in Philippians chapter 2, verse 12, where he tells them, produce your own salvation or your own deliverance. It's exactly the same word. He says, for I know that this, my Roman imprisonment, will turn out for my deliverance or salvation. And he's not talking about getting eternal life. He's not talking about being saved from the lake of fire. He already has that. And he's not talking about a deliverance he also already has, because what does he say? It will turn out for my deliverance. He's not saying, I've already got the deliverance. He's saying it's going to become my deliverance. I'm going to be delivered. And what kind of deliverance is he talking about? Is he talking about, oh, I'm going to be released from prison and I'm going to be free? That would be our first thought, but we saw that that isn't what Paul's necessarily thinking. In verse 19 of chapter 1, for I know that this will turn out for my deliverance through your prayer and the supply of the Spirit of Jesus Christ, according to my earnest expectation and hope, that in nothing I shall be ashamed. But with all boldness, as always, so now also Christ will be magnified in my body, whether by life or by death. Paul's saying it's going to turn out for my deliverance, whether I live and release, or my deliverance by death. Because Paul is saying, the most important thing for me is that Christ be magnified in my body, whether I live or whether I die. Paul says the worst possible thing that could happen to me is for me to chicken out and say that which would bring discredit to Christ as I'm undergoing persecution. Is it possible that he's saying here, you Philippians ought to be heading towards the same kind of deliverance that I'm heading towards. That is my goal, of not bringing shame to Christ. Whether your deliverance comes by life or whether your deliverance comes by death. I think that what Paul is telling these Philippians is he's giving them advice in chapter 2 to look at life the same way that Paul does. Let's look a little further at how Paul views life. Philippians 1:21. For to me, to live is Christ, and to die is gain. He says, my whole life is wrapped up in Christ, but if I die, I'm going to be right in his presence. And so he says that that's gain. Verse 22. But if I live on in the flesh, this will mean fruit from my labor. He's saying, well, I'll be able to do some things for the Lord if he leaves me here on this earth. But in verse 22, he concludes it with, yet what I shall choose I cannot tell. Should I choose for Nero to put me to death? Well, then I'd have deliverance right into the presence of God. Or should I choose for Nero to keep me alive? As though Paul were the one in charge of what Nero decides. Well, if he allows me to stay alive, then I'm going to be able to minister to others, but if I'm put to death, I will be delivered into God's presence. And Paul really is treating this as a choice in verse 23. For I am hard pressed between the two, having a desire to depart and be with Christ, which is far better. Nevertheless, to remain in the flesh is more needful to you. And being confident of this, I know that I shall remain and continue with you all for your progress and joy of faith. Paul says, I'm going to contend for the faith. I think God's going to leave me here so I can contend for the faith. I can strengthen you in your faith. And that's the deliverance that he ultimately wants. So, we get back to Philippians 2:12. Therefore, my beloved, talking to fellow believers, as you have always obeyed, not as in my presence only. He's saying you have really, from the heart, obeyed. Because I can be way off in Rome and I can be in prison. and you're still obedient. You know, it's one of those things where, you know, as your kids get a little older, you go away for a little while, and you leave them some responsibilities, and then you find out, okay, they can make the bed, they can put out the trash, they can do all these things when you're home, and when you're saying, do it. But what happens when you're away? Do you come back home and you find the house an absolute catastrophe? Or do you find that they have actually followed through on some of the responsibilities? Paul is saying that these Philippians are not like little kids who, if they're not being watched, make the house a catastrophe. He's saying, even when I'm not there, you are doing well. You've obeyed even when I'm not present. But now you're especially showing that in my absence. So what I want you to do is I want you to produce a deliverance for yourselves with fear and trembling. What he's saying is I want you to produce a deliverance in dependence on God. In fear and trembling is saying that he wants them to do this by the power of God. He's not saying, I want you to get out there and just produce your own deliverance by your own strength. I want you to do it in fear and trembling. I want you to be focused on the Lord. And you carry this out. I'm not going to be able to deliver you. I'm way off in Rome. I can't do it for you. You guys need to do it. And it's like, when the parents are away, are the children going to do what they were told to do even when they're not watched? Or do they need someone there to watch them? Paul's saying, you Philippians are grown up enough that you can do this. You can follow through. I have confidence.
But I think that's what mine is saying. John already knew. He said, be careful to put into action God's saving work in your lives. Use God to do this action in your lives. And for God is working in you, giving you the desire to obey him and the power to do what pleases him. So they have to go to God to get this done. And now they already have the salvation. They need to keep that salvation, that God helped them do this while he's gone, while Paul is absent.
Well, the thing that I'm seeing that's different is the deliverance that he's talking about is a deliverance they don't yet have. It's not talking about, when it uses salvation or deliverance, it's not talking about that they're saved people, that they've believed in Jesus Christ. But he's saying they need a deliverance. They need a deliverance that's yet future to them.
Well, and I think that's what I said. They're going to have problems. People are going to be on them.
Okay. Very good. Very good. Okay. I might be just a little thick-headed.
No, probably me.
So in verse 13, for it is God who works in you, both to will and to do for his good pleasure. So as they do what they are supposed to do by the power of God, God will then work through them to produce this yet needed deliverance that they don't yet have. And so, he's looking at these Philippians who don't have him there to be with them, to help them, who are facing a very difficult situation, and he's saying, you can do it by the power of God. You can produce the deliverance that is needed by God's power, and that power comes through his word. So he says, do all things without complaining and disputing. He's telling them, if you keep on having the fighting that's going on between you, you're not going to get this kind of deliverance. It just isn't going to happen because you're not then working by the power of God. You're working by your own power to get on top of this person on top of that person, and you're all focused on your own power. You're not focused on God's word. And that's a big problem that they're having there. They're facing external pressure, and what does that cause them to do? Start fighting with each other. Isn't that the way that things go? Things get a little tight, they get a little tough, and people are looking at the outside and saying, oh, they're all against us, and then what happens? We start fighting. And he's saying, that is going against the deliverance that God wants to bring about. He's saying, your heart is in the right place on a lot of things, but if you keep fighting with each other, it's just not going to work out the right way. So, do all things without complaining and disputing. When I look at Paul, and I look at him describing his imprisonment, I never see him complaining. Now, if I spent a night in jail, or a week in jail, or a month in jail, or a year in jail, what would my attitude be like?
If I won't be dead. Could you be there? Could you not be there? I would have done something really wrong and I would put in jail, then I would think, yeah, I probably should be there.
Okay, but Paul knew that he hadn't done anything wrong. And he said earlier in this book that even the Praetorian guards, the guards that protected, they were like Nero's secret service. Even they knew that he wasn't there because he was a lawbreaker, but he was there because of the name of Christ. Now, Paul wrote a book before he wrote Philippians. He wrote this a lot earlier. Look at 2 Corinthians. So if we were looking at what Paul could have written at the time that he was here in prison in Rome, now as he's writing the book of Philippians, he could have written much more than he wrote here. This was a number of years earlier in 2 Corinthians chapter 11. He's comparing himself with some of the people that are coming in and stirring up trouble in Corinth. Starting at verse 22 of 2 Corinthians 11. Someone want to read verse 22 and then someone can read 23 and we'll go on down to... verse 28. So someone could read verse 22 and then...
Are they Hebrews? So am I. Are they Israelites? So am I. Are they Abraham's descendants? So am I.
Are they servants of Christ? I am out of my mind to talk like this. I am more. I have worked much harder, been imprisoned more frequently, been flogged more severely, and have been exposed to death again and again.
5 times I received from the Jews the 40 lashes minus one. 3 times I was beaten with rods. 1 time I was stoned. 3 times I was shipwrecked. I spent a night and a day in the open sea.
I have traveled on many long journeys. I have faced danger from rivers and from robbers. I have faced danger for my own people, the Jews as well as from the Gentiles. I have faced danger in the cities, in the desert, and in all the seas. And I have faced danger from men who claim to be believers, but are not.
I have labored and toiled and have often gone without sleep. I have known hunger and thirst and have often gone without food. I have been cold and naked.
Besides the other things that come upon me daily, my deep concern for all the churches.
That was written many years before Paul wrote Philippians. He could have added to that list. The amount that he has suffered, and yet when you read Paul, you don't see him say, oh, woe is me, I mean, you know, my life is just awful. It's like, Lord, give me another opportunity to tell someone about Christ who wants to put me to death. And Paul is there ready to tell people about Christ. He was telling his Roman guards, and as a result, the message even penetrated right into Nero's own household, as we see at the end of the book. Look at Philippians 4:22, starting at verse 21. Greet every saint in Christ Jesus. The brethren who are with me greet you. All the saints greet you, but especially those who are of Caesar's household. The message has penetrated into the very house, the very palace of Nero. And Paul always looks at the opportunities that God has given him instead of looking at, well, oh, woe is me. My life is awful. And if we wanted to trade stories with Paul, he could top anybody's stories as to what he has faced in his life. And yet we look at him and he's always optimistic because he sees it in terms of God has given another opportunity for the word to go out. And as he talks to the Philippians, he's saying, if you get all focused on the little things, you're going to be fighting all the time. And if you're fighting all the time, are you looking at those that need to hear the word? Are you thinking about those who may be opposed to you that have not yet believed in Christ? Yes, we see Paul taking steps to correct things that happened to him. When he was beaten by Roman officials, he would say, I am a Roman citizen. You have no right to do this. And it's very interesting to see how they back away and say, will you please not tell anybody? But Paul was not one who was busy trying to get people into trouble for the persecution. He looked for opportunities to minister to people. We saw him there at Philippi, and how did he treat that Philippian jailer? He treated him in grace. Here the Philippian jailer was ready to plunge a knife into his heart. Paul says, do yourself no harm. We're all here. None of us have run away because of the earthquake. And he had an opportunity to minister to that man. Paul is looking for the opportunity to minister. He's not looking for the opportunity to bicker with people. Look at how he even regarded fellow believers that wanted to harm Paul. They had a correct message about Christ. Their message that they were giving out was a true one. Let's see. Philippians chapter 1, starting at verse 12. But I want you to know, brethren, that the things which happened to me have actually turned out for the furtherance of the gospel. I'm in prison. I can't go wherever I want. And as Paul's saying, you know what? They've got me locked up and I can't go anywhere. Woe is me. I can't talk to anybody about Christ. I mean, here I am all locked up. He says, my imprisonment has turned out for the furtherance of the gospel. Verse 13, so it has become evident to the whole palace guard, the Praetorian guard, and to all the rest, that my chains are in Christ. And most, notice he didn't say all the brethren, But most of the brethren in the Lord, having become confident by my chains, are much more bold to speak the word without fear. And I think now he's talking about the rest of the brethren. Some indeed preach Christ even from envy and strife, and some also from goodwill. The former preach Christ from selfish ambition, not sincerely, supposing to add affliction to my chains. He's saying, there are people out there that are telling others about Christ, and they're thinking that God's going to say, whoa, look at me, look at what I'm doing, and, oh, Paul, he's in prison. He must deserve it. And they're trying to heap reproach on Paul. And does Paul say, oh, those awful people? He's able to say, I rejoice that the message of Christ is getting out, even if some of the people that are getting it out are doing it so they can say bad things about me. Where's Paul's focus? Is his focus on, does everyone like me? Is everyone nice to me? And if they're not nice to me, then I'll be mean to them in return? Or is he saying the really important thing in life is that the cause of Christ go forward? And that's what he's telling these Philippians. He's saying, get your mind focused on that which is really important. Isn't that what he prayed for them? Remember when he prayed for the Philippians? Let's go back to Philippians chapter 1, verse 3. I thank my God upon every remembrance of you, always in every prayer of mine, making requests for you all with joy, so that your fellowship or your participation, your financial participation in the gospel from the first day until now. Being confident of this very thing, that he who began a good work in you will complete it until the day of Jesus Christ. They have financially supported Paul sacrificially from the very start, and as a result of that, we even have the book of Philippians. They supported him even when he went away to Thessalonica. He was only in Thessalonica for 3 weeks, and twice they sent him gifts. Verse 7. Just as it is right for me to think this of you all, because I have you in my heart, inasmuch as both in my chains and in the defense and confirmation of the gospel, you are all partakers with me of grace. For God is my witness how greatly I long for you all with the affection of Jesus Christ. And this I pray, that your love may abound still more and more in knowledge and all discernment. He recognizes that there is a great love for the Lord by this congregation, even though they are fighting, they are bickering with each other, but he wants their love to abound still more. He wants it to grow in knowledge and all discernment, that you may approve the things that are excellent, the things that really matter. He says, I want your love to grow so that you will focus on that which is really important. Are we starting to get an idea of what Paul thinks is really important? Is getting that word out, not having internal fights, but standing together, united in one mind, striving for the faith of the gospel. For them to have one mind as Paul had one mind, as Christ had one mind, as we looked at for the past couple of weeks, he's saying, when it gets tough, when you come under persecution, things start getting rough, you've got to focus on the things which really count. And that's the direction that Paul is aiming them at. I'm sure that it's become quite evident how I'm approaching this book. We get a little way into the book, and how do we figure out what the book is saying? We go back over what it's already said. The way that we come to understand what a book is about is by seeing how all the pieces go together. When Paul would write a letter, he had an overall objective. The way that we come to understand books is by looking at the whole book, because Paul is seeking to make one overall point in this whole book. He might take four chapters to do it, but we don't figure out a verse just by looking at the verse. We find out what the verse is talking about by seeing how the whole book ties together. And so we keep going back into chapter 1 because this whole book ties together. So let's go back to chapter 2. Paul has in verse 15 a purpose clause for what the purpose for them doing all things without complaining or disputing. Another way of looking at without complaining or disputing is becoming one-minded. And he said that a lot in this book. If they think together as a team, they're not going to be bickering with one another. As they think united, as they focus on that which is really important, the cause of Christ, rather than some of the smaller things that are causing them to have fighting, he says that you may become blameless and harmless children of God, or blameless and harmless, children of God without fault, in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you shine as lights in the world. It's dark out there in the world. And what he's saying is we have the opportunity as believers to shine as lights. Now, what kind of light do we shine as? Not like the sun, like the moon. Sun shines onto the moon and the moon reflects light. Christ, God, through his word, shines on believers. And we reflect his glory as we use his word in our lives, and it has an impact in our life. The way that we shine as lights, by standing together as a team, united together by his word. Focusing on that which is truly important. Now, he's not saying that they would become children of God by doing this. They became children of God when they believed in Jesus Christ. But it's very important that we have what kind of children of God they would be. Children of God without fault. Because what are believers who are fighting one another and who are bickering? They're still children of God, but they're children of God with a fault. He wants them to become children of God without that fault, so that they might shine as lights in the world there as they are in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation. Sounds like he was writing in 2012 America, doesn't it?
Happened to see the TV news program about the neighbors that were complaining about the family that was Satan worshiper and had a dead Christmas tree up in the yard with skulls and things around them. And
I vaguely remember it.
How would you approach the situation? The thought I had was, well, I guess you have to go ask the question why they believe that way and care.
We should look for opportunities if they our, we, when we're confronted with things like that, we have responsibility to look for ways to be able to present truth. And those are obviously people who have been very busy hiding their eyes from any light that has come to them.
But, oh, yeah, there's good witches and bad witches out there. I had a friend, she says, I'm one of the good witches. Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's called living on another planet.
it's in our neighborhood.
Yeah.
Was strange how they wanted to use our laws back when they were a religion.
Yeah, that was their
religion. And they wanted the same rights that we have as Baptists in our religion. And how can we talk about them because that's their belief? We're supposed to have the right to believe the way we want to, so they want their rights. And I get stuff too that I even approach them.
Sure. Definitely a lot of prayer. Yeah, it's a very interesting thing. People want the right to do this, the right to do that. But have you ever noticed how they don't want anyone to be able to exercise the right of being able to proclaim a message?
That was on the radio the other day. There was a firefighter talking about how God helped him. He's glorifying God, and somebody asked the radio station, don't put anything on there when you talk about God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's we definitely are in a time and a society that is opposed to the light shining. And in this passage, within this book, Paul is talking about more than, well, if I apply the word, then people will be drawn to ask me why. Paul's here looking for us to be looking for opportunities to shed that light. He's looking, wanting us to look for opportunities like Paul looked for opportunities. And obviously there are difficult situations. I mean, I've had conversations with atheists. I've had conversations with shall I say, a lot of very interesting people. Sometimes you fly on a plane and you're there with someone for a long time and it's like, well, this person is definitely in left field. Lord, help me to be able to minister to this person. I mean, sometimes you're there in those situations and you're saying, Lord, I wouldn't mind being anywhere else right now. But
the trials and tribulations Paul had. Mm-hmm. It's this, and we don't even have it as bad as he had it.
No.
They were actually put to death mm-hmm. when they were worshippers of Christ and put into jail and killed and beheaded. And this church of Philippi, they're facing more struggles and adversaries worse than we ever. Mm-hmm. Can think of now. Atheists, yeah, they can talk a lot and do other, but they're not going to sit there and kill us
right.
yet. I mean, we haven't gotten to a government that will kill us.
Mm-hmm.
But he was trying to strengthen this church to get to the point that they could face possibly death, I would think, in the
sure.
name of Christ.
I think our government has turned an interesting corner. We're not put to death and so forth here, but our State Department is not very protective of Christians, Christian American citizens who are proclaiming their faith in other countries. I mean, our State Department used to be particularly concerned to go to bat for American citizens, but right now it's for politically correct American citizens. So, yes. Diane, you?
I guess, what do you do with a person that says, no, I'm just not going to
Well, we ultimately have to respect their decision, their approach to things, but I was with Frank one time. This Frank Tyler, I often talk about him. He was our local church evangelist in the church that I pastored in Southern California. That is, he was on staff to train people in evangelism. And so he was always talking with people everywhere. And one time he talked with a man who, I saw the guy just, just came alive and said, how dare you tell me about your religion? And I mean, he just really came unglued, and Frank told him, well, I appreciate your honesty. But he said, let me tell you what I'm doing. I'm not trying to offend you. He said, I see it like there are people in a car that I can see is on fire and it's ready to blow up. And would you want me to rescue you if I knew that your car was ready to blow up? The man said, yes. Well, Frank said, that's why I told you about the Gospel of John. And it was interesting. The man did settle down. He still wasn't interested, but he did settle down because he was able to see that Frank was not doing it for belligerent reasons, but had a noble intent in wanting to say something. And we run into all kinds.
Well, then to say that when you run into people that have a hardening of the heart, it's like a brick wall, you got to walk away. Maybe let other people have their
sure,
because you can't do anything.
Absolutely. Yeah, Jesus speaks about, you know, there's a certain point where you shake the dust off your shoes and you go on to the next town, as in that particular case. Yeah, it's what we're advocating is we're looking for opportunities. Sometimes those opportunities are very short-lived and it becomes a closed door. But the idea is we're supposed to keep looking for opportunities. Because when you think about it, where else are people going to get the message other than from Christians? And most Christians are afraid to say anything. And so we need to look for opportunities.
The neighbor of this person's opportunity, she said, was to cut down one of their signs.
Yeah.
That's probably what I would have liked to
do. So, how is it that they are going to shine as lights in the world? Verse 16 says, holding fast the word of life. The life-giving word, the message of life. As most of you know, we have an organization called Message of Life. And this passage and one other in 1 John are where I came up with the name for our organization. Because what is translated here is word. Another word for word is message. And so this is one of the two passages from which our organization receives its name. The message of life. Holding it fast. So that I may rejoice in the day of Christ, that I have not run in vain or labored in vain. Paul is saying that when these Christians are evaluated at the judgment seat of Christ, and he has opportunity to see how things turned out, says, for all the effort that has gone into your church, everything that I've done, I want to have reason to rejoice because the word has gone forth from Philippi. If the word doesn't go forth from Philippi and I see that you've caved in, it says, the work that I've done didn't add up to anything. Didn't really add up to ministering for the Lord. And he's saying, if you hold fast the word of the Lord, the word of life, and you are striving together for the faith of the gospel in unity, my life and the time that I've invested here will pay dividends. It will be worth it. Yes, and if I am poured out as a drink offering, they would pour it out onto the sacrifice, and he's saying, that's what's happening to me. My life is being poured out. My life is being poured out into all the people to whom I minister, all the churches. And I'm, let's see, if I am poured out as a drink offering on the sacrifice and service of your faith, I am glad and rejoice with you all. He can look at his life as he is getting older, he's in prison, he foresees at some point his ministry on earth ending. He says, I can rejoice if you go forward. For the same reason, you also be glad and rejoice with me. Despite the fact that they are undergoing persecution, he wants them to join with him in rejoicing. But how can they join with him in rejoicing at the day of Christ? By having stood firm for the faith of the gospel, having focused on the things which really count, and their lives to be seen as being poured out as a drink offering for the Lord. Paul gives us in this book of Philippians his sense of what is important in life. What in life is worth dying for, and what in life is worth living for. And I would say, Paul says, Christ. We need to look for the opportunities. Paul says, that's why we've been left here. God sees us as a drink offering being poured out. We have that as our opportunity, as our legacy.